so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game? Yeah!
Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, it's time for another Toy Department. Derek Madden, he's Matt Kolsky. I have to admit, Kolsky, that I'm playing a little bit hurt today because I'm nursing a hangover.
Oh, wow. Just some drinking while you watch the Warriors?
That's exactly what happened. A little drinking before I watched the Warriors, a lot of drinking during watching the Warriors.
A little bit after?
A little euphoric celebration after the Warriors. Probably the general tension of the Warriors didn't help, but
sure.
How are you feeling today?
I'm a little tired. I did not imbibe at that level, in part because I had to drive home from San Jose at around 11 p.m. because I was at a Roger Waters concert last night.
Oh, wow. The
beautiful benefit of the West Coast is I watched about 3.5 quarters before the concert started and the last 8 minutes at set break. So I didn't miss the game at all, really. But I did see Roger Waters play the hits of Pink Floyd. And have you seen him?
I have. You remember when he played AT&T Park a few years back?
Vaguely.
On the Dark Side of the Moon.
Okay.
I saw that, and I had this, like, hamstring injury at the time that was really bothering me, and I wound up having to leave, like, fairly early because I just I couldn't stand up anymore, and I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to walk out of this giant stadium. So I left, but it was really great. Like I was disappointed that I felt like I needed to leave. So
here's it's fun. My takeaway, which certainly says more about me than Roger Waters, is funny and somewhat apropos to the podcast's general themes. It was a great show. It was so much fun to be in the building as the hits of Pink Floyd were played. As you hear them, at least for me, you realize just how many incredible songs that I love are Pink Floyd songs. Like, it's something I hadn't thought about a lot recently because, you know, the time where I listened to Pink Floyd all the time was like high school and college. But, man alive, you know, they go from Wish You Were Here to Breathe to Money to, you know, Animals, just like bouncing all around this incredible catalog. And it was spectacular to watch. The lead guitarist Roger Waters has playing with him are tremendous.
Is G.E. Smith still playing in his band?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
Do you know? You know, G.E. Smith used to be the Saturday Night Live guy.
Oh, no. I don't think he was there. I would recognize him. I know who you're talking about. The guy they always zoomed in on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, because he used to be G.E. Smith in the Saturday Night Live band, you know?
Right. Yeah. No, I don't think he's in the band. It's younger guys for the most part. But they play most of the stuff almost verbatim. You know, like the Comfortably Numb solo was the Comfortably Numb solo that I know. Note for note.
I made a tragic error. I said I saw Dark Side, but it was actually The Wall. I saw him do The Wall.
Either way, it's like a greatest hits of Pink Floyd.
Totally.
Show.
But that's more what I'm used to, though, with Roger, is kind of him really focused on a single record. You know what I mean? So
right.
I think a hits thing would be pretty cool to see. And that tour is coming through here. So
I would recommend it. Us and Them is the tour. And yeah, it's really pretty much the hits. It covers pretty much all their albums. I mean, less stuff from, you know, Piper at the Gates of Dawn or whatever. But we got some of The Wall. We got some of Dark Side, we got Comfortably Numb. They did not do Shine On You Crazy Diamond, which I didn't look, but it occurred to me that maybe that's more of a Gilmore number. But excellent to watch, had a great time, and yet, as I almost invariably do, and again, when I go see Roger Waters, and he's just you know, he's a front man at this point, basically. He plays bass for the most part, wanders around the stage. He doesn't do any musical sort of gymnastics on the stage. But I found myself at a certain point thinking, this is great and fun and definitely not a Fish show. Because, like, once you start, and I would imagine a Pink Floyd show was more like this in the mid-70s, once I start seeing this sort of psychedelic rock music, I start wanting the musicians to like explore and play not just solo, which these guys certainly do. And again, this is not a criticism of the musicians by any stretch, but I start to want to see like collaborative, you know, jazz style improvisation. And I like, it always leaves me a little bit, which obviously, again, this says much more about me than Roger Waters, because yeah, the band was great. They were great. They had a huge video screen and these screens that dropped down from the ceiling that were awesome. I mean, they did, but it's more like seeing a Broadway show to me than a true rock concert. Because to me, a true rock concert involves not just musical talent and ability, but this like level of collaborative musicianship that just, I still only know one band that really does it.
It's like, if you ever wanted to know the difference between Kolsky and I, it's that Kolsky goes to this sort of thing hoping that that improvisational jazz-inspired thing is going to happen. And I literally go hoping that that improvisational jazz-inspired thing is not ever going to happen.
Please don't. Derek's like, please don't waste my time. Yes. And I'm like, please waste my time.
You know, and it's interesting. Like, Pink Floyd is a thing to me that I sort of came to a little later in my musical life, which is kind of weird because I like a lot of other bands that Pink Floyd fans kind of like, or bands that get compared to Pink Floyd. You know, certainly Radiohead kind of being one of those. And another one that I think is in the same boat, and I'm actually kind of curious about how you blended this in with the Warriors, because I'm going to go through a similar thing. Game 4 is Friday night. Mm-hmm. I have tickets to Tool on Friday night. And
Tool, I think, is number one on my list at this point of bands I have not seen that I want to and realistically can see.
Yeah. Now, I don't have that West Coast luxury that you do. The game starts at 8. I'm going to guess Tool is going to go on at 9. And so,
well, you have one advantage that the poor 50-something man who sat next to me and my friend did not have, which is you're in Minneapolis. So that's not guaranteed someone will spoil the game for you. Because we sat down, and the guy next to me, we were watching on the fourth quarter on my phone in our seats, and the guy next to us was like, hey, don't say out loud who wins. But it turned out we were in some seats I had gotten via radio, and so some buddies from radio were sitting near me, and in the middle of the first set, I hear – Kolsky,
oh,
and
no.
Turn, and someone goes, "We won!"
See, and I don't think that's going to be a realistic option. To be honest, I'll probably be wearing some gear, and so people would come up to me. So I think,
my point is, if you don't wear gear, maybe no one will come up to you.
Maybe,
and then you might actually be able to record and watch.
Yeah, I just. Our plan is.
Have you seen Tool before?
Yeah, a couple times.
Then maybe you just chill at the bar in the.
Yeah, I think our plan is to watch an hour, you know, like 8 to 9, watch the game, figuring they'll go on about 9. At like halftime of the game, head over, you know, watch 45 minutes of it,
and then try to catch
the end somewhere, maybe in the arena, maybe around the arena. And just roll for it that way. But I don't feel like I can, you know, this is history. Like, we're headed towards history, right? And Tool is a very rare occurrence, obviously, and it's, you know, it's history in its own way, but.
Yeah, fo.
Yeah, if fo is on the table, I want to see that, so.
Yeah.
And, you know, look.
So I just watched, There's in beautiful downtown San Jose, there is a Whole Foods with an outdoor roof deck bar.
Of course there is.
So me and my friend Katie watched the first half at the outdoor roof deck bar at Whole Foods, ate some wings and some tacos, and then walked the two blocks over to SAP and watched the third quarter on my phone via ESPN app as we waited. And then at set break, the ESPN app replays all these games. It's really great. And so I just replayed the fourth quarter to watch it, even though I knew that at that point the Warriors had won.
Yeah. So, I mean, there'll be some combo of ESPN app and all of that stuff, but I don't know. It's going to be interesting, I think.
And the nice thing ultimately about a concert, especially if it's like, if it's a decision between not watching the concert, there's really no rule that you can't sit in your seat, listen to the music, and watch something on a small screen. Like, you know, if it comes to that, you could do that. You could still hear Tool while you watch the game.
Yes, that is true. It's going to be, I mean, are you feeling like now that, I mean, look, we know the series is fait accompli. It's close to fait accompli.
Yeah.
Is game four close to fait accompli? It does seem hard to imagine that the Cavaliers are going to be able to come out with the same type of intensity that we saw in game three.
You know, I don't even really think it's an intensity issue. It's to me, it's a very simple question. And you know, if we wanted to get deep into this, we could have a really interesting discussion about the Cavaliers' strategy, which I think is poo-poo crazy pants. If they're going to persist in playing at the Warriors' pace, which is to say fast and running up and down the floor and high scoring, they're going to need LeBron and Kyrie, or you know, if J.R. Smith goes nuclear for some reason, but they're going to basically need LeBron and Kyrie to beat people one-on-one all day long. And they did it for 3.5 quarters, and then they looked like they ran out of gas to me. And even if it's not that they ran out of gas specifically, and it's just that they missed shots, you know, is it possible they both go for 45 instead of 38 and 39? Yes, because they are that good. And we saw last night.
They certainly did it last year.
Good both of those guys are. And that was I mean, that was their big win at even strength last year was the game six win when they both had 40, right?
Yeah.
Am I remembering that correctly?
Correct.
And if they had both gotten to 44 yesterday, the Cavaliers probably win. But Steve Kerr said it in the postgame. We just trust that if we keep playing good defense and keep making it hard on them, that as good as LeBron and Kyrie are, they can't do it for 45 minutes. And they literally have to do it for 45 minutes to beat this Warriors team. And that's only if the Warriors don't play their best.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, last night they get 38 and 39. You know,
and
what was
that,
five three-pointers from J.R. Smith? Love had a decent game, and they still lost. So it's, you know, it's rough.
And they missed their last eight shots, and I think Kyrie and LeBron were combined 1-for-10 down the stretch.
Did you see the stat that LeBron, in 46 minutes, it was a +7? And they lost the game by 5.
I know.
So there is the issue of just what happens to them when LeBron is out of the game.
Think about that. They were outscored by 12 in like two and a half minutes.
Really less than 2 minutes. So, you know, that's a problem for them. I do think they're going to slow the game down because I felt like they did that in the second half to some degree of success. At some point they made a concerted effort to switch into matchups on offense that got Steph isolated on LeBron, and that seemed very successful. Uh-huh. They still haven't really unleashed LeBron in the post. Like, I feel like there are things that they can do.
But Derek, think about what you just said. They're down 3-0. Why haven't they unleashed LeBron in the post? Why didn't they do it in the second half of game one?
Yeah, no, well, that's a question for two individuals.
I can't answer that. That has been the most stupefying to me about this series is You have the model. It's the way you managed to win a couple games 2 years ago, and it's part of the way you took over the series in the second half of that series last year is bully ball. Slow it down, beat it up, and put LeBron in the damn post. Nobody on this team can guard him in the post, with the possible exception of Zaza Pachulia, and that is not a good solution for the Warriors. So I just don't understand the plan. And
you don't feel like Draymond can guard LeBron in the post?
I mean, he can give it a good shot.
I feel like Draymond's like really good in the post. Like,
he is, but LeBron is a beast.
Yeah. I mean, and you could very easily foul Draymond, you know, get Draymond in foul trouble fairly quickly in that scenario.
Exactly. And by the way, last night the refs were ready to get guys in foul trouble.
Yes, they were. Yes, they were.
And so why don't you force that if you're the Cavs? And not only have they played that way, but every time they've been asked, they double down. Oh, no, we're a team that runs. That's how we scored. That's how we got here. But, like, that's idiot logic.
It is a little bit. Honestly, I thought that was a Belichickian possum media play, you know, coming sure. into Game 3.
In which case it would have been, like, moderately clever, although obviously the Warriors are prepared. But yeah. but even as a Belichickian move, that would have been, like, C-minus Belichick.
Right.
And it wasn't. It was just nonsense. It's just them committing to a failing strategy. I don't get it at all. And it casts it makes the coaching and management situation in Cleveland look even murkier. You've already got a bunch of assistants without contracts, a GM whose contract is expiring, and now either Tyronn Lue is committed to a losing strategy, or he's unable to convince LeBron not to commit to a losing strategy.
Right, it's one of those two things.
And yep. either way, that's not good.
Yeah. Either way, that doesn't spell security for Ty Lue.
Because, nor does it spell...
Because if it's LeBron, right, like they're not... It's not like they're going to get rid of LeBron. They're going to try to find someone who can talk LeBron out of a losing strategy.
Right, and I'm going to say again what I said with Cassidy last week. It also brings my picture of the next 4 years of the NBA into much clearer focus. Who can beat this team?
Yeah.
Who can even challenge this team?
Well, look, we're going to see some teams load up and try for sure.
Sure.
The thing that I asked Cassidy last week was, you know, if they can pull off 16-0. You know, and we kind of laughed it off. And look, even I soft-pedaled a little bit because you want to respect the Cavs.
I feel like such a sissy for not going with the sweep prediction, because I believed it would be a sweep, but my brain just kept going, you can't pick a sweep against LeBron.
Man.
You can't pick a sweep against LeBron. And I should have trusted my gut.
I didn't believe it would be a sweep. And I still think it's entirely possible that Cleveland gets
a game
here at home.
Of course it is. But I think we've seen what I expected.
Yeah, no, it's played out that way. Like, one team is more talented. I think ultimately, right. Look, there's it kind of comes down to this, that Cleveland is just going to blow a few switches on defense for easy buckets a quarter, and they have to score enough to overcome that, and that's really hard to do against a very good defensive team. The Warriors
really
don't make those kind of mistakes. Their ability as a team up and down the roster – with the exception, I thought of McCaw last night, who looked a little lost on the defensive end.
Patrick McCaw, yeah. I want to talk about him the way you talk about your kid after their first T-ball game, you know?
I love
Patrick McCaw. I have no doubt he's going to be an effective NBA player, if not a legit high-end starting NBA player. But rookie with limited experience in his first finals is exactly what he looks like.
It seems to be a tradition. It's like the James Michael McAdoo ceremonial. This guy's getting minutes.
Difference is that McAdoo hasn't played a meaningful, more than two meaningful minutes for this team in a game for his entire career, whereas Patrick McCaw contributed on more than one occasion this year. But you can tell he gets on the court and he's like, oh my God, I'm in the NBA Finals. Okay, yep. Oh, what's going on? This yep. is crazy.
I can't believe this is happening. That's LeBron over there. but yeah, what is, you know, the Warriors have an uncanny ability to continue to make the right switch. And they really seem to have a good plan and know what they want to do defensively. And that's it's just a huge advantage.
And it's a credit to the coaching, but probably more so that communication and success on defense proves even more what you see on offense, which is you just – and it's why Kevin Durant came here. It's a bunch of guys that care about winning and don't care about credit.
Yeah.
It's just we communicate, we play as a team, we pull the rope in one direction. A rising tide lifts all boats. That's the core philosophy of this team at its core from the players, and it makes all the difference. It's how you put – you cannot put together a team of this quality with this top-flight talent if that talent is not willing and you know, able to, at certain points, subjugate the ego for the betterment of the whole.
Yeah. Where are you on the entertainment value of these playoffs and, you know, the entertainment idea of witnessing dominance and history and the excitement of that versus the entertainment of watching competitive basketball?
Well, last night was the ideal, right? A game where both teams lead in the fourth quarter, where four or five different players are doing spectacular things when you know, throw Clay in there with the top four. That is peak playoff basketball.
Yeah, you now, were kind of hoping for like the Pacers-Cavs series, right? Where you had a sweep, but it was decided by like a total of like 16 points. You know what
right.
I mean?
If you're going to get a sweep, let's see competition. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's what's interesting is this playoffs has had a lot of the opposite, where series have actually gone on a little while, but there hasn't been enough close basketball. And I think some of that is coincidence. You know, the Warriors steamrolling everybody is kind of a problem, but boy, when you get a game like last night, there's no lack of entertainment, right? So I really do think it comes down to
a
game by game.
I think the blowout's entertaining, though, too. I mean, look, obviously I have a rooting interest in the team that's doing the crushing, and that makes it a lot easier to watch, but they're just so fun to watch play basketball. And
yeah.
The Cleveland too when they were killing people.
Some...
You know what I mean?
Cleveland Sorry, what
too.
That?
And Cleveland too when they were killing people in yeah. earlier rounds, you know?
No doubt. Both of these teams are beautiful to watch. That's not necessarily the case about some of the Celtics Wizards blowouts. Some
Correct.
Of those were yeah. brutal to watch the end of. So it that's why I say it's really it's hard to judge that as a whole. I think most of the this playoff sucked is people tie it to, oh, well, we knew the Cavs and Warriors were going to win the whole time. But that's not actually the problem. We don't care. In fact, we wanted the Cavs and Warriors to win so they would play again.
Yeah.
We don't even care if it's a sweep. We do care about the watchability on a game-to-game basis. And then people tie that narrative back to the idea of Cavs Warriors, but I don't think it's actually connected.
No. And look, yeah, I mean, the first two games ended non-competitively, but were very competitive for three quarters.
Yeah.
And this game was fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah, classic NBA Finals game.
Yeah.
The best talent doing the best things. LeBron and Kyrie making shots that were mind-boggling. Kevin Durant doing the I score easier than anyone in the history of the game act. Like, just everything you wanted.
Yeah. Look, to me, if your takeaway from this, and I've seen some of it on Twitter, is Kevin Durant took the easy way out, then, like, I'm not totally sure what you understand about basketball or life, if that's your takeaway, because you're missing the important stuff, you know?
Yeah, you know, these guys can't win.
Yeah.
If he takes money to stay in Oklahoma City, then it's how come you value money over winning?
Yeah.
Like, the hater's going to hate, as they say.
Yep. Please live your life in exactly the manner I want you to live it in.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's just, it's gross.
When that many people follow you, you can't make them all happy.
Right. That's 100% true. Anyway, these finals have made me very happy. And hopefully I'll have a
me
good
too.
Play for game four. And,
me too. I wouldn't, you know, not only because it is a positive for my gambling pursuits, I wouldn't mind a Cavaliers win I think it'd be fun for the Warriors to clinch at home. I think, you know, to look back on this as a sweep in 10 years probably will diminish how good this Cavaliers team was, because they didn't win that many regular season games. But for 13 playoff games, they were spectacular.
Sure was. And there's no – look, there's certainly no assurances that this is the final chapter of this story. You know what I mean? We could get two more of these easy. So
no, and I think, you know, the scuttlebutt, as it were, the buzz, the word on the street seems to be that if it in barring drastic turnaround, the Cavs move is probably to find a place to send Kevin Love for a different cast to try again next year.
Yeah. Well, and look, you know, Boston was a pretty decent team and they're going to have the number one pick in the draft.
Yep, and some cap space.
Milwaukee's got young and exciting players.
I do think the East is getting better. Yeah. I'm not sure any of those teams are getting better enough to be a serious challenge to the Warriors, but anything can happen.
And look, in the West, you know, the Wolves have a young nucleus of guys that could come together. The Pelicans could potentially figure out the Anthony Davis and Boogie thing. Like there are, you know, this Chris Paul to the Spurs. Like there are things that can happen that can change the balance of this equation. So.
Yeah, I'm in the same place, which is it's hard for me to see a rising challenger, but I'd love to be proven wrong.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, so we should jump to the leftovers?
I think so.
Yeah.
Let me start here. Do you believe? Okay, so actually, we should start here. There is going to be major spoilers, obviously, because this was the series finale of the show, and we're talking about the end of the show. So
before you ask the question that I'm pretty sure I know you're going to ask, I just want to sort of take a 30,000 foot view of this whole thing for a second, because you were, you know, 100% out is maybe the wrong term.
No, not at all. I wasn't 100%.
Yeah, you just hadn't watched any of the show coming into this year.
Right.
And so, you know, within a pretty short time, you really viewed it all in completion. And so I'm curious for your, like, start to finish view of this series. What did you think? Where does it rank in the television hierarchy? Was it ultimately successful for you?
Okay. I'll answer the last question first. And I think I would give a, if not resounding, at least confident yes. A generous thumbs up.
All right.
When the screen went black. What were some of the other questions? Where does it rank is tricky for me. I probably need more space. It's not on, to me, it's not at the level of The Wire. Which for me stands alone atop the heap.
It's just really hard to compare a show like that to The Wire, I feel like.
Well, of course it is. Everything's hard to compare. But ultimately, The Wire's combination of incredible social impact, almost journalism, with almost perfect narrative storytelling and the complications and machinations of the cases involved, to me, it's the Michael Jordan of TV shows. It has an it factor that I'm not sure can ever be matched. Is Leftovers, though, in that next tier with Sopranos and Breaking Bad and other shows that I think are phenomenal and I really love? I think it's less consistent episode to episode over the three seasons maybe than a lot of those. But maybe not, because certainly The Sopranos lasted long enough to have some slow points. Breaking Bad feels like it had a better median level. The Leftovers was a little more all over the place, but at its heights, the level of TV making that Damon Lindelof was engaged in is certainly what we mean when we talk about peak TV or whatever term you want to use.
I have Breaking Bad in the same tier as The Wire for me, for what it's worth. So
I know. And Breaking Bad is spectacular. Breaking Bad deserves its own second tier for me underneath The Wire, but
obviously we're splitting hairs, but it's
right. Exactly. I do think The Leftovers for me is probably at the bottom of that Breaking Bad, Sopranos tier, if that makes sense.
Yeah. A tremendous show. And I really just appreciate the daring and the ability to go for it. Just sheer desire to create WTF moments.
And I think we have to credit him, especially given the way he was, I think, unfairly discredited for the way Lost wrapped up. I think in retrospect here, it's very clear that there was a plan in place and it was executed.
Absolutely. And, you know, honestly, in, I guess we can get into this now as we talk about the episode a little bit more, the last episode. A little bit more closure and directness than I was expecting. And look, I think Lindelof, more than any of these other sort of auteurs, is really paying attention to what people say about the show and actively trying to defy certain expectations. And
he's certainly admitting it more than anyone else.
Yeah, and I think that he and by the way, I would definitely recommend Alan Sepinwall's fairly long conversation with Lindelof after the show, where you get a lot of his insight out of this. But yeah, I think he was like thinking, nobody thinks we're going to get any answers about where this place is, or so let's just answer it. And let people sort it out.
That's the question, is do you believe Nora's story? And now we're getting specifics, but do you believe Nora's story about going through to the other side?
I 100% believe it.
I think I do too. I didn't even honestly, it seemed to fit so well. I didn't really think much about the fact that she might be lying until I was reading and listening to reactions afterwards.
Yeah.
And I do think it's a thought worth entertaining.
Certainly.
And I actually texted with my Leftovers text friend Kareth about this. The idea that she both in that episode, she and has made the point repeatedly, she says she's constantly saying, "I don't lie." So she makes her
which we already know is a lie.
Right. It's not true. But we do know she at least nominally values honesty.
Yes, but she lies.
Correct. On the other hand, not only does she lie in that episode on multiple occasions, but everyone in that episode is lying all the time.
Right.
The nun is lying to her about the dude that just climbed out of her window. Mm. You know, Kevin is lying about remembering everything. Mm-hmm. It's an episode filled with liars. And yet, when she tells her story, certainly you believed it, I believed it, and Kevin says he believes it, and I think we have every reason to believe he believes it. Because here's this guy who's been experiencing his own weird death vision. We don't know if he's crazy. We don't know if he's going somewhere. We don't know if he's having weird death dreams. Could be anything.
Right.
And but
is he, is your view, is Kevin going to the same parallel dimension where the departed went to?
My answer would be no, he is not. But also my answer is I don't know, and I'm not sure it matters.
Right.
Because it doesn't. I think, and that's what I settled on, and that's why I think I give this the thumbs up, is that the way they bring this together at the end is very true to what I think we all thought the show was about, which is managing grief and how grief looks different through everyone's different lens and what each individual is going through and how hard that is to capture and understand.
Yeah. And I thought it was a really key and kind of poetic point that we've spent all this time focused on the grief of these people who lost the 2%.
Right.
You know, well, in the meantime, there are this 2% living somewhere where they lost the other 98%.
Right.
And they're like, are trying to deal with that. So
where the world is actually ruined.
Right.
Where they simply don't have the humans and the resources to do things that we've become accustomed to. The world we've been watching has been rocked with insanity and all sorts of other issues because of the departure. But generally speaking, everything still works. Okay. They're still living a life that looks mostly like the life we live today.
Right. Here's my logical question about all this.
Quickly, hold on. Okay. Before we get to a new question, though, let me finish this thought on the idea of coping with grief.
Yeah.
Is that when we finally do get to this sort of key finale scene between the two of them, To me, what the show is saying, and I think it's a beautiful sort of thing to say, is we all have stories of our own grief. And they may be literally true. They may be not literally true. They may be some imagination in our head. They may be a death dream. They may be a journey to another land. But ultimately, as long as you can find someone or some place or some environment that can accept you and your grief, as long as you can say, I believe you, and reach out and hold hands with someone at the end of the day, that's all we can do to cope.
Yeah.
And for having watched these people go through all the insane stuff they've been through, to reach that sort of simple, beautiful end point is, I do think that's an achievement.
Yeah. And I think it's, the product of really, having a finite endpoint and knowing the period that you want to put on the sentence from the moment that you're writing that season.
And probably learning the lesson from Lost that throwing extra stuff in the middle is only going to make the ending seem hollow.
Right.
I really do think even if I had my questions at certain points, the whole experience tied up in really a beautiful little package.
Yeah. So, all right. So here's my question. And it's stunning to me, thinking back over this show and and the start of the season and what it all means, that like my key question would somehow come down to Mark Lynn Baker, but like here we are, right? So if Mark Lynn Baker had been over kind of to the other side and come back, right? That's
yeah,
and seen the machine, right? So then why is it that Carrie Coon has to Nora, thank you. Sorry, I'm terrible with names. Then convince the guy to build the machine in her story. Wouldn't the machine be already built? And if there was a machine that could send people back and forth over this line, wouldn't all of the 2% be just trying to get back to their families? Like, wouldn't J-Lo have wanted to come back? And, had the fame and the resources to find the guy and make all of this happen.
Yeah, I don't know. Hadn't thought about that.
If travel back and forth between the dimensions is possible, you would think that more people would be really attempting to reunite with their families.
Right. And you could understand if that option wasn't available to everyone, but if it was available to Mark Lynn Baker, you'd think J-Lo would be able to figure it out.
And if there are, even if it's a small number of people, like I don't know how many people use this service prior to Nora, but let's say it was a few dozen, you know what I mean? Like, wouldn't accounts of people suddenly showing up in that world like start popping up? And I don't know. Like, I feel like this would, there'd be more. It's the one thing that kind of makes me doubt the story a little bit. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Nora's story, not the story of the show.
Yeah. Hadn't thought about that. Don't really want to.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah. No, obviously there's some holes in that process. But again, I'm not sure it matters. And I'm not sure it matters. Even if that makes you not believe Nora's story.
Right.
I'm not sure it matters.
Look, even if she just wanted to get away and decided to hide in Australia for 8 years. Wait until that moment, and that doesn't take away from that moment, right?
No, exactly. And that's kind of the point, is even if her story was a total fabrication and what she actually did was decide not to go and run away and hide as a dove farmer in Australia, the point is she was processing her grief. And finally, it seems at the end, we've got two people that have processed their own grief enough to help each other.
Yeah. Yeah. As we wrap on this, just what a collection of acting performances and characters, like really developed characters whose.
The thing I might be the most disappointed about now that The Leftovers is over is that I no longer get the incredible experience of watching Carrie Coon be Nora And then 2 days or 3 days later, watching her be the detective in Fargo and just being like, my God, this woman is incredible.
I got a feeling you're going to get the chance to watch her do some other stuff, though, at some point.
I think so, too.
Maybe not twice in a week, but she'll be around.
She's just this whole season of TV has just been a mind-blowing realization for me of how wonderful an actor she is.
I believe I had that.
You did have that. You had that.
She's great. Yay for Carrie Coon. All right. So do you want to jump into Wonder Woman?
Yeah.
Because we saw Wonder Woman along with lots and lots of other people. I'll let you do your take first.
No. We have to hear your take first because you're the skeptic.
Yeah. All right. Fine. I think my take is, I probably need to stop discussing comic book movies on this show. Hmm. That was kind of my take. I definitely had that thought in the theater. I this is no shade on Wonder Woman, because I think for the most part it's a very well executed version of this. The lot of stuff goes boom, a lot of the effect scenes are fantastic. Like the notion that a woman could somehow not direct a movie like this is so dumb. Insane to me, and so and it so clearly proves it's so dumb that the fact that we waited this long to have a feminine hero, or like that we thought that people wouldn't want to watch a woman blow stuff up and kick the crap out of people, seems sort of ludicrous to me, because it's clearly effective. And the second that you watch it, you go, oh, wow, yeah, she's a badass, you know?
Right.
She's beautiful, you know? Like, there's all of that. Like, all of that stuff works.
And she was good, I thought. You didn't think she was good?
I didn't think she was great. Okay. Here's part of the problem for me is that, you know, and I've heard Patty Jenkins, who directed this, talk about, like, I wanted to make a film about love and the triumph of love. And I thought the on-screen chemistry between her and Chris Pine was sorely lacking, and that the romance was underdeveloped. And I really felt like the film sort of turning on that was one of the least successful aspects of it for me. So I had an issue with that. I also felt it was really kind of just weird to retrofit the comic book supervillain, God's story onto an actual real world political situation where, like, we're just making the Germans like actual supervillains. Like, that felt really weird to me.
Did that bother you in Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Did that bother me in Raiders of the Lost Ark? No, but I was also like 10 when I watched Raiders of the Lost Ark. So,
well, yeah, but I mean,
talking about Nazis versus World War I Germans, like, it's a kind of a different thing. You know what I mean?
Is it?
Yes. Like, World War I Germans were not, at least to my knowledge, and I'm far from a great World War I historian, but like the lack of the, we're trying to exterminate a race off the planet thing changes your concept of evil. It seems to me like that World War I was a more garden variety political disagreement.
I guess, in as much as Germany wanted to take lots of parts of the world that weren't theirs.
Yes, right. But that's different to me than mass genocide on a scale never before perpetrated.
No, you're right. It's different, but it's not like sympathetic.
I'm not saying it's sympathetic, yeah.
I don't think there's much debate over them being the bad guys in that situation. Bad guys are bad guys. I think so here's the problem. Interesting story. My parents were with me when I saw this movie. My parents are visiting me right now. And my mother does not see movies like this. My mother does not like action. My mother does not. She's like you, but add on a whole layer of never in her life has she had any interest in comic books or superheroes or any of that stuff, you know? So she saw this movie because it's woman driven, which I think intrigued her philosophically, and because it was so well reviewed. And I think there's two things that happen. or have happened. One is the idea of something being certified fresh has turned into this idea on Rotten Tomatoes, has turned into the concept of this movie must be great, when in fact it's kind of like the way people misunderstand gambling odds or lines.
Right.
It doesn't mean it was when Wonder Woman gets 93% on Rotten Tomatoes, it doesn't mean anyone gave it a 93% out of 100 rating. It means 93% of critics
said it was more good than bad. And right. Exactly. Yeah. Like, I mean, I think this is a perfect example. Like, if I was a critic writing a review of this movie, I would definitely rate it fresh, but like, right. I didn't enjoy it all that much. So,
right. And the other component of that is I do think as time has gone on and the quantity, not only in number, but in percentage of Hollywood movies of comic book films has gotten so high, is that many, if not most, if not all movie reviewers have sort of acquiesced and are reviewing comic book movies as comic book movies. It's a categorical review in as much as
they're graded on a scale now, kind of.
See, you would say graded on a scale. I wouldn't call it that because I think this is the correct and fair way to handle it. I guess I might describe it as accounting for willing suspension of disbelief. Mm. And I feel like that's the way – it's expectation management. That's the way movies should be reviewed and looked at.
But I don't
– a comic book movie is not expected to have the intellectual impact of The Leftovers. It's just not.
I get that. And I'm not – by the way, I don't expect it to – yeah, like I don't know. Like I feel like my expectations are in line. I'm just not that entertained by it.
But that's a separate issue. Yeah. That's not you saying the movie is poorly executed or made.
I thought
that's
it was well executed, saying, yeah.
Yeah. You're just saying, I don't like this kind of movie, which gets us back to what you saying maybe this is just not something we need to talk about. Might be right.
It was a little bit weird. Do you think it was a little bit weird that, like, spoiler alert, that, like, the big bads at the end are, like, old men? Like, she's fighting, like, old men?
I thought that was a fun twist. I think also David Thewlis is fun to watch.
Yeah, well, it was certainly
have any problem with that.
Given what we're watching from him every week, now it's a lot easier to buy him as a evil badass than maybe that other guy who was great. He's a great that guy that the Ludogorets.
Is that his name? You knew his name?
I did know his name. I don't know why. I don't know how I was able to pull that one out.
That was impressive.
Did you find the origin story effective? Because I felt like a lot of that was like kind of a waste of time too. I mean, I know they, not a waste of time. Obviously, they needed to set up the whole Ares thing a little bit, but right. I don't know. There was a long time on the.
I liked watching the badass Amazon ladies like train and fight.
Like watching that. Yeah, but didn't it seem like most of that was an excuse to get those scenes?
Yeah.
Were you emotionally like when Robin Wright Penn eats it? Were you like, did it really pull at you?
There were no tears, but again, for me, these movies come with a combination of willing suspension of disbelief and like, I bring my own sugar to handle the salt that I'm swallowing. Like it's a comic book movie, and I am, because of this conversation, still interested in you seeing and us discussing Logan, because to me, that's the one that has been pretty different. Wonder Woman is a really good version of a superhero movie, I would say.
Okay.
And I think, did you see Batman v Superman?
No.
Okay. Well, that was a good decision. Did you see any of the Zack Snyder helmed? Is that the only
pieces on cable?
Right.
But yeah, like at post 300, I got off the Zack Snyder train.
Right. So this movie,
he's involved in this, by the way, as a producer. He's not,
I know. Well, he's producing all this stuff, but yeah. But the sort of Zack Snyderiness, the darkness, the bullet time, all that stuff was toned down to a much more palatable level here, where it didn't distract from the story and it didn't make the whole thing a drudgy, dark mess. And again, like, I guess I understand if you didn't love the chemistry, but I thought all the performances were pretty convincing. I've really enjoyed seeing people like Robin Wright and Connie Nielsen in these, you know, superhero-esque roles. And ultimately, yeah, it had the cheesiness and the unbelievability of a comic book movie, but I thought it was well done. Whereas Batman v Superman stunk.
Yeah.
You know, so I do think whether you enjoy it or not, this is a pretty important movie for the DC universe.
And like I said, I feel like I can appreciate, I watched this movie and I appreciated, like, this is well executed and not, you know, this could have been much, much worse. Like, I get that, but it doesn't mean that I'm entertained. And I don't know, like, I just feel like, you know, I watched the trailer for that Charlize Theron action movie. You know, and I think about that, or like Jason Bourne, or even Baby Driver, and I just rather see movies about people.
Well, I'm very excited about Baby Driver, so that's on our list. And I agree with you about to a degree, about seeing movies about people. But I don't know. I think ultimately our differences here come down to me being willing to throw away the sort of conventional way of criticizing film to enjoy these things, yeah, and you having no interest in doing that.
I don't know. It's just on a basic level. I just feel like there aren't that many more. There's a reason I still call it superhero fatigue, is I just feel like there aren't that many more ways to tell this story.
Well, that's why I do think it would be interesting to talk about Logan.
Yeah. So, and I've seen plenty of them. I'm not seeing the majority, and I'm still seeing plenty. You know what I mean?
Well, that's part of the problem, is if you have superhero fatigue, you never get a chance to rest.
Yeah. Yeah. They keep
coming
at
you. I maintain and will repeat, I think you should watch Logan, because I think it stands alone in the genre in terms of what it does and how it is made and the sort of stuff it deals with. Still got a guy with adamantium claws, but it is the superhero movie that I think grades out the best on a regular movie scale. All right. If that makes sense.
We'll make Logan my, like, Danny Glover, like, one last job.
Well, that's the other thing, is I do wonder, and I hope we're doing the podcast long enough to find out if the difference between us is just whatever, 4 years of age or whatever it is.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. That and our love of our love or lack thereof of improvisational jazz-based rock and roll experimentation.
It seems like that is certainly bound to come into play here. Yes.
You know, on that thread, did we talk about Tom Petty at all? I went to see Tom Petty.
You told me you went to see him on the texts. I don't believe we talked about it on the show.
So, you know, it was. I really enjoyed it, and I won't get too far into it, other than to say, like, the last time I saw Tom Petty, he was kind of really going out of his way to not really play a lot of hit songs, and this is a 40th anniversary tour, and so he's just letting it rip. Same songs every night. It's the same 19 songs every night.
Can you list them?
I don't think I could list them.
I bet we could get to 10, though.
Oh, yeah. And he leaves, like, he didn't play The Waiting. You know what I mean?
Really?
Like, he leaves a few on the table. And it's still, you know, chock full of hits. Like, that guy wrote a lot of great songs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they are, you know, all played really well. Mike Campbell is an American treasure who I don't think enough people really realize just how fundamentally great he is as a guitar player.
Right.
So I'm curious, like, does...
Well, that's another thing. And after I just saw Roger Waters last night, is they lost, what, one heartbreaker?
Yeah, I think one.
Most of those guys,
the key
that's
guys
still
are still there.
Heartbreakers.
And honestly, yeah, like, he joked about it when he was introducing the band. They introduced the drummer, and he's like, yeah, you know, this guy's we still call him the new guy in the band. He's been here 24 years.
Right, so, exactly. Like, that you're really seeing Tom Petty and the damn Heartbreakers when you see them.
They had two new backup singers. They were sisters, British sisters. One of them was like smoking.
By the way, I forgot to mention Roger Waters has Lucius.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they were cool. Really good.
Does the idea of, even though they're great songs, and I think there is some measure of improvisation, it's hard, obviously I didn't see other nights on the tour. But like the same set of hits night to night, like, does that bug you, that notion?
No, Well, and no, and I hope you didn't misunderstand what I was saying about Roger Waters. Like, if I'm going to go see Roger Waters or Tom Petty, yeah, give me a solo here and there, but like, play the hits. I want to I want to see that stuff live. I want to hear it coming out of the big speakers dancing with thousands of people. That it's a different experience. It's just I can't help at some point during that experience having a slight lament that it's not my particular favorite experience.
Fair enough.
That's all that is. It's not a condemnation by any stretch.
Of the experience.
Yeah, no, I had a great time last night, and I'm sure I'd have a similar great time at a Tom Petty show. I probably won't see it because it probably is out of my price range, but philosophically, no, I'm totally on board with that.
One thing I will say that sort of surprised me coming out of that is that like Wildflowers era Tom Petty holds up really well against the rest of his catalog. And I don't think people think of that as like his great, you know, one of his great works, but it really is.
That album is underrated because that was the one that, well, when did that come out? Like 94,
I believe, yeah.
That's the Tom Petty album that I was like, oh, here's a guy called Tom Petty. You know, I'm 13 years old when that comes out.
Yeah.
So like, first of all, that album's fantastic. Second of all, that really was sort of my entree. And then, you know, Jerry Maguire had Free Fallin' and like the Tom Petty sort of renaissance happened and I dug deeper into it. But Wildflowers is excellent, man.
Yeah, Wildflowers, it really is excellent. It is also, you know, as he's like playing Mary Jane's Last Dance, which I think was like 96 and kind of like the last like big MTV hit.
Like, yeah, I remember that video vividly.
Looking at that guy and thinking, like, this was a major MTV star. Like,
I know. And he's already, what, 60 or something at that point?
It boggles the mind a little bit, you know. Yeah. Also, the screen in the background, you know, both between sets and during the set, often flashback old video footage of various points in his career and, like, late 70s, super young, skinny, kind of punk rock looking Tom Petty is awesome. With like hair and like.
But he was never an attractive man.
Not in the conventional sense, no. And I'll leave it there.
He is a weird looking dude. And also at that point, he looks like a poster advertisement for heroin.
Yeah. And also Joe Walsh opened and told a.
Oh, I love Joe. Okay. If we want to talk about criminally underrated, slept on musicians of the classic rock era, Joe Walsh is in the top two or three for me.
He's got a bigger body of work than you think, and man, people go nuts when he plays any Eagles song. You know, like In the City, like Brought the House Down. You know what I mean?
The James Gang.
Yeah.
Walk Away. Do you realize Funk number 48 and 49 are two of the best rock jams of all time?
Did not. Did not do Walk Away. In like a 9-song set. Yeah. Did not do Walk Away.
Well, I would have been disappointed. That's my favorite Joe Walsh song, but. The guy was everything from like original rock with the James Gang to whatever the hell the Eagles were doing to solo songs called I Love Big Tits. The guy is he's a goof, but he played some phenomenal music and he wrote some great riffs.
Watching
he's
the whole
a riff master.
Arena of people relate to Ordinary Average Guy, like live in real time was an amazing experience.
That's great.
And he told the story, and if you've seen Joe Walsh, maybe you've heard the story because I have a feeling it's a regular part of the set. But he told the story about how some friend of his talked him into karaoke, and as a joke, when it was his turn, they had him play Life's Been Good, and so he went up there and sang it. And there was some guy in the back who was like, that sucked. Only Joe Walsh can sing that song, man. They launched into it, and it was like just so quintessentially Joe Walsh in like that way about him. And you know, you really see why other musicians just kind of like revere him.
He also, like, first of all, I think he's one of those guys that almost everyone who ever listened to rock radio knows 3 to 10 of his songs, even if they've never heard his name in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how many people know all the words to Rocky Mountain Way and have never heard of Joe Walsh?
Yeah, totally. Or that riff to Funk 49, or, you know.
Like, that is one of the key rock riffs of all time, and nobody knows who Joe Walsh is, but they love that song.
Yeah.
That to me is a special thing. A
lot of soloing in that set, though. You definitely you would have enjoyed that part of it for sure.
Joe Walsh, man, I'm telling you, he can play too. He can still play.
Yeah, so he's still got it for sure. All right, that was a lovely little detour. I feel like there was something else we needed to cover. Was there something else we needed to cover?
We've got both Fargo and Better Call Saul on the table, but probably only time for one of them.
Let's do Saul, because I thought, you know, there was, look, a lot happened on Fargo, but I think maybe another week of Fargo would be a good place to check in on that.
Do you
want
to wait a week to try to understand what the hell we just watched? Because most of what I have to say about Fargo is
what the hell did
the
we
question,
just watch?
What the hell?
I think that's a good idea, because I kind of like a second viewing of that one. Yes. Sorry. So let's hold Fargo for next week.
I loved it again, but Noah Hawley jumped into like some Twin Peaks territory in this episode.
Yeah, and I would also say, I guess we could save it for next week. But the bus scene set, like, just as a set piece, you know what I mean? Nobody's doing that on television. And
no, Noah Hawley is doing things no one's doing. In every single outing, he's doing things no one else on television is doing.
Yep.
Okay. All right.
So anyway,
Call Saul, I feel like we've been sleeping on a little bit.
I feel like this week. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it continues for me to now this much of this season after the first episode or two, I feel like this season has been operating at a Breaking Bad level.
Yeah. And I feel like we're really getting into the meat of this transition right now, and it's really exciting. And when you look at where Jimmy McGill, I don't even know. It's at this point, you almost don't even know which name to call him.
Yeah.
But his ability, I'm in a desperate corner, and I'm in a desperate situation, and now have zero qualms about cutting the corners that I need to.
Right.
Aspect of him. It's exciting because we already have some idea of where that goes, and that now that ball is rolling downhill, you feel like it's going to be a fascinating story to watch, particularly with kind of the parallel of Gus and Mike and their upcoming union.
Yes, that handshake was so tantalizing at the end of the episode, and obviously we're in major spoiler alert territory here, but two things popped into my mind with what you just said. One is, I think to your point, Jimmy gives us the ethos of Jimmy in that conversation with Kim where she's like, listen, he's lying on the ground playing the guitar with a half-broken back. And she's like, I can float us. You don't have to literally break your back to make a few bucks. Like, I'm here for you. We're good. And he says, what are you talking about? The money's in your hand. I'll take care of my half. I'll do whatever I have to do to cover my half.
Yeah.
And that is where you're like, that's who this guy is.
That is who this guy is.
He believes certain things are important, and they're not necessarily the same things other people believe.
Yeah.
But if he believes in something, he will push every boundary and cross every line to get it there. And that's who we saw, or that's who we see now. But I think in Breaking Bad, we saw him become someone who sort of became a boundary pusher without the higher cause.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I think, I think the Saul of Breaking Bad is a guy who's sort of permanently painted into a corner where, where maintenance and survival are pretty much what he knows, and he is going to be slipping Jimmy at any point that he needs to.
Exactly.
Right. That's the Saul we've come to know. And I did
and
think it was
sort
a little
of the
bit
guy
weird
we saw at the community service site.
Yeah. That someone like Kim, who is so sharp and strong and a pretty good judge of people and Jimmy in particular, kind of lets that go. Even though there's some real red flags there. You know what I mean?
Right.
And maybe they've written her as having a blind spot for him, but
I mean, I think that's how I read it, certainly, is she's in love with him for whatever reason. And so, but you can see it. And I think that's why I think Rhea Seehorn does such a good job is I feel like I see that decision in her face every time she has those conversations with him.
Yeah, she really does play that, like, I'm weighing and now I'm going to act like,
right.
like look at her
like
face.
You can see in her eyes, like, I know he's pushing it too far.
Yeah.
But I don't know how to stop him, and I'm here. I love him, and I'm going to ride it out with him.
Yeah.
And that's the second thing I was going to say is – because we know the end point, you know, I think there's a natural sort of knee-jerk reaction that's like, well, we know the end point. How interesting can it be? But for me, I mean, obviously, we know something is going to go wrong in this relationship. Now, whether that's him screwing it up and her leaving, or God forbid something horrible happening to her or whatever, she's not a character in his life in a couple of years. And watching their relationship evolve and her try to figure out how to reach him, knowing that there's the hammer is coming, creates for me an incredible, like, intense sort of tension while I'm watching it that I think contributes to how good this show is right now.
Yeah, it just creates a situation where the how matters. And you look at like the plot of Nacho and the pills and Hector, and you know that you're seeing both of those people again down the line.
Right. And
so you wonder how we're gonna get to that. You know what I mean?
Right. And we can imagine that somehow this pill situation is going to lead to the medical situation that we see in Breaking Bad, right?
Right, right. And eventually bells. So many bells.
Bells. A lot of bells. A lot of bells.
And that's also part of what's great is that, like, I mean, I guess this is a spoiler if you haven't seen Breaking Bad, you know, but, like, the death of Gus Fring is one of these crazy impactful moments. And you certainly know a lot about who those people, at least especially Gus, and a little bit Hector, I think, by the time that, you know, that stuff comes. But, like, now to have this even deeper understanding of the relationship of those two individuals, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It brings a whole, you can look at that bell ringing in this, like, whole new light. And Vince Gilligan's a master. He just is, and it's weird to me that there are people who are kind of who disregard the show. Like, I don't know how you could see Breaking Bad and not think and watch an episode or two of this and not think, like, oh, this is a formidable part of the TV landscape.
I completely agree. I mean, I also just I don't know that enough has been made about Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah, I agreed.
Here's a guy who made it to, you know, his mid-40s or 50 or whatever he is without having a really serious acting role. And that includes Breaking Bad. Better Call, like Saul Goodman in Breaking Bad is primarily comic relief.
Yeah.
He's a clown. And he was great, don't get me wrong, but not very nuanced. And most of his career has been playing very goofy characters, and he is brilliant at it.
Yeah.
Mr. Show is, you know, legend.
Look, you can also say the same thing about the work that David St. Hubbins and Squiggy is turning in on the other side of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I use those terms just because Michael McKean is a 100% dramatic role, and he's nailing it.
No, there's no humor.
Yeah. Nailing it.
And this is right. This is the guy. This is Squiggy the Spinal Tap?
David St. Hubbins is Spinal Tap. Squiggy is Laverne and Shirley. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Right. I think never he saw was Laverne and Shirley. Yeah. But yeah, this is Spinal Tap. This is the dude from Waiting for Guffman.
Yeah.
Like, this is a guy. These are two comic actors giving absolute tour de force dramatic performances. And like you said, McKeon's entirely dramatic. What Odenkirk is doing on a weekly basis to play this complicated, interesting, at times funny, at times tragic character, I just think he should be winning awards.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's really going under-recognized.
I love Mr. Show, and, like, you just wouldn't have guessed that guy was capable of this, you know?
Not at all. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying, is like, it's almost like this was a hidden talent, and getting to see it is such a delight, especially for people who have enjoyed his comic work.
Yeah, agreed. All right, a lot of good stuff out there in the world today.
Man, right? Yeah, we're going to have to dive deep into Fargo next week.
Yeah, I think it's time we do a serious investigation into what the hell's happening on Fargo. And we'll look forward to that. Is there anything else you want to assign as homework while we're here? I guess Logan is kind of the thing to watch.
Yeah, I would like to have a quick chat about Logan. So if you can get to that, let's do it. Are we going to I think we're in a possible break week, depending on what happens.
Yeah, I think let's call this a break week. We'll take 2 weeks. We'll Fargo will have developed a little bit at that point.
And then I think potentially in that same episode. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's say this. If the Cavaliers win 2 basketball games before next week, we will have another podcast.
You might get a special bonus episode.
If not, we will take the week off. And I think when we come back, we will have Julie Lake of Orange is the New Black, because the new season of that returns. So
that'll be
in that 2 weeks. I believe it's this Friday that it drops on Netflix. So watch a few episodes and we'll have an interview with an actress.
All right. I apologize for the break. I'm going to be drowning in bourbon this time next week. So,
poor baby.
Well, I'm not sad about it, but I'm gone. Sorry for all of you guys that I'll be drowning in bourbon.
All right. And stop bragging about your drinking exploits.
I'm going on the trail, man. I'm going on the whiskey trail.
I guess we're gonna have to hear about that in a couple weeks as well.
Probably. I'm gonna see a bunch of bands that you've never heard of while we're there, so maybe one of them will be interesting.
All right. Sounds good.
All right.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed, the lights out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.